This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The National Rifle Association held its annual convention over the weekend in Phoenix. It's been a stormy period for the gun group. George Bush resigned in protest over a fundraising appeal that referred to federal gun control agents as jackbooted thugs. Critics of the NRA have accused the organization of using inflammatory language that feeds the paranoid conspiracy theories of extremists. This convention has been portrayed as an internal power struggle between hardliners who consider the right to bear arms perhaps the most important guarantee in the Bill of Rights, and moderates who want the group to tone down its rhetoric and return to its earlier emphasis on hunting and sport shooting. The president of the NRA was reelected, and the leadership emerged with its power base intact. A little later, we'll hear from Osha Gray Davidson, the author of A History of the NRA. First, we'll hear from Tanya Mataksa, executive director of the organization's lobbying group, the Institute for Legislative Action. We called her in Phoenix and asked what she thinks was the most important outcome of the convention.
It demonstrated to everybody who was here, and there were many members of the press, both the national and international, that the NRA is unified behind its leaders. The NRA is the organization that believes in the Constitution, the rule of law, and freedom, and will fight to ensure that the Constitution is upheld and that the freedom is preserved.
This convention of the NRA has been portrayed as a fight between the hardliners and the moderates, the extremists and the moderates. And yeah, and you are grouped in with the extremists in that division.
Well, first of all, that's been portrayed by people who have no idea of how the NRA is really structured. The so-called people who wanted to oust the current leadership of this organization was a small, minuscule, a handful of people who are disenchanted former board members who have been trying to get reelected to the board for several years now and have failed miserably. There was no big split. There was no great palace intrigue. And yesterday's election of the officers of this association was what I predicted 5 weeks ago when I was queried by the press, that all the officers would be reelected.
Looking back, do you think that the fundraising letter that referred to some federal agents as jackbooted thugs, do you think that letter was a mistake? If the NRA had a chance to rewrite that letter, would you have advised that the letter be rewritten?
Well, let's talk a little bit about political rhetoric. First of all, that letter was sent to NRA members, and NRA members understand the problems of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. We've lived with that agency for years. We've seen it in its times when it has been a fair government agency, and we've seen it in the times when it has had internal problems leading to abuses. We think that's what's happening this time. So it was dealing with specific cases of law enforcement abuses of power, and that's what the sentence made. What happened was the sentence was taken completely out of context and broadcast around the world to people who have no knowledge of what the rest of the letter was talking about. And so what we see here is a attempt by some to tar and feather our political rhetoric as meaning it applied to all law enforcement officers. And Wayne LaPierre, who wrote the letter, said that if law enforcement felt that it was being unjustly targeted, that was never his intent. His intent was to talk about specific abuses. And if you listen to the rhetoric of the victims of BATF abuses and other federal law enforcement agency abuses, their rhetoric makes ours pale by comparison.
What do you think the impact on the NRA has been of President Bush's withdrawal?
I think it's actually been very wonderful for the NRA. We've had people calling and saying, I'm going to upgrade my yearly membership to life membership to make up for George Bush. I'm going to join. We've had other members who've called and said, please send us some information. And we sent them the ad that we published in most major newspapers last week explaining the history of our attempts to get the government to pay attention to this real problem of abuses. And, you know, when they read that letter, they say, gee, these are awful. Why haven't you told us about this before?
There was a Time CNN poll that found that 68% of gun owners disapproved of the harsh language used in that fundraising letter.
Well, that's fine. They may disapprove, but when they hear about the problems with an agency that is going into people's homes in the middle of the night, terrorizing them, and then saying, oops, wrong address, so sorry, they say, you know, maybe that rhetoric was strong, but it's based on some real problems in the agency.
You know, getting back to George Bush's with resignation from the NRA, did you consider that not much of a loss? After all, there had been a campaign within the NRA to expel George Bush because he supported the assault rifle ban.
Well, yeah, and I think that's sort of an interesting, and I'm glad you brought it up. A few years ago, after he banned the importation of some semi-automatic firearms into this country, there was a move afoot among NRA members to get him out of the organization. And our radical leadership, those who you've said are extremists, did not do that. We said we didn't think it was warranted and that we would not throw him out. So, I mean, so much for extremism, right?
What would you say is the connection, if any, between the NRA and the militias?
The militia movement in this country is a separate movement from the NRA. We have a statement about the militias that was ratified, actually, at the members' meeting, which incorporated the 1964 board resolution talking about our opposition to extremism, to paramilitary organizations, to those organizations that advocate the violent overthrow of the government, with our position that we neither support nor condemn any kind of militia groups as long. And our basic contention is that the Second Amendment, like the entire Bill of Rights, deals with the right of the people, not the rights of militia or any other group of people. It's an individual right.
Do you think that any of the rhetoric of the NRA helps breed or helps justify the more extremist and paranoid language within the militia movement?
You know, I find it very difficult to think that NRA, when it tries to point out excesses by our government, is breeding any kind of language from anybody else. If you'll look at our language, where we have for 2 years now asked in very, very moderate tones for our government to look into problems, I don't see how you can make that statement. For example, let me just give you the chronology. In April 19th, 1993, the day of the terrible tragedy at Waco, we put out a press release, and we said, we ask our government to look into this through the courts, through the Congress, and through the administration. Nobody said anything. It was just ignored. On January 1994, this is now 9 months later, the American Civil Liberties Union, the NRA, and a host of other groups from all parts of the political spectrum got together and wrote a letter to President Clinton asking for him to appoint a commission to look into federal law enforcement agency abuses against individual citizens. We listed some 25 cases. Only two of the cases dealt with ATF. That was Waco, and the second one was Ruby Ridge, the Randy Weaver case. The others dealt with the Drug Enforcement Agency, Bureau of Indian Affairs, Immigration and Naturalization Services. These were all government agencies with cases to say, hey, there is some problem here in the management style of federal law enforcement agencies. We were greeted by stone-cold silence from this administration. Then we have the terrible, horrible tragedy at Oklahoma City. And somehow there has been, in some people's minds, some kind of idea that our rhetoric is the cause of that terrible, terrible tragedy. There are NRA members who were victims in that tragedy. There are NRA members who were rescuers in that tragedy. And the person who put the flag up on that building was an NRA member. We have been affected as much as any other group in this country by that tragedy. I can't see any linkage, and I can't see that our actions or our words can be linked to it in any way.
There seems to be a growing rift now between law enforcement and the NRA. I think this is in part because of the NRA's criticism of federal agents, in part because of the NRA's support of the so-called cop killer bullets. Last week, the Secret Service banned the NRA from participating in its annual shooting competition, and the International Association of Chiefs of Police banned NRA ads from its monthly magazine. How is this growing rift affecting the NRA?
Well, let me just try to clear up a misconception. The whole idea of so-called cop killer bullets was one invented by our adversaries, and they're very good at getting that phrase sort of planted in everybody's mind. NRA is the organization that went out and made a definition of armor-piercing ammunition, and that's what the law's all about, and we helped craft it. We are pro-law enforcement. We support the rule of law, and we support the magnificent job that most law enforcement personnel perform every day.
You know, as you know, a lot of law enforcement officers say that it is more difficult to enforce the law when there is a growing number of guns owned by Americans.
I think you'll find that the rank-and-file law enforcement who testified on Capitol Hill at the beginning of April, say that they don't have a problem with guns in the hands of the law-abiding. NRA supports law-abiding people's right to own firearms. We do not, and let me reemphasize that, we do not support the criminals owning firearms.
But nevertheless, it's very easy for the criminals to get firearms.
Well, but you know why it's very easy for criminals to get firearms?
What?
They won't obey any law, let alone a gun control law. I mean, you know, it's sort of strange. We keep passing more laws and the criminals keep laughing. You could go into any major city, whether they have tough law enforcement, tough gun laws or not, and purchase guns illegally and drugs and everything else they want, because that's the criminal way. You do it without regard to the laws on the books. There's never been a gun control law that has reduced crime. Gun control laws don't do anything about crime.
There is a growing number of guns, and that creates a lot easier access for criminals, and some people turn criminal after having been law-abiding, after they've purchased the gun. So in a way, it would be impossible to keep guns out of the hands of criminals, because a person who's law-abiding one day can kill their neighbor the next and become a criminal.
Unfortunately, what you're saying now is that you're going to presume everybody is guilty before they even have a chance to prove their innocence. That's where that comment leads.
No, I think what I'm trying to say is the feeling that many people have, that the more guns that there are in America, the more Americans who have guns, the greater the odds that some of those guns will be used to commit crimes.
I can't buy that. What you have is you have a criminal element. Those are the people who commit the crimes time after time after time. And NRA has been very strident in its rhetoric about criminals. We want them apprehended. We want them taken off the street. We want them put away for a long time. After all, NRA was the organization that went to Washington State in 1993 and really started the three strikes and you're out bandwagon. NRA is very much against criminals, for law enforcement, and for our right to keep and bear arms.
I want to get back to the rift between the NRA and the law enforcement community. What effect do you think that's having on your organization?
Well, first of all, if you use the International Association of Chiefs of Police as having a rift, they have never been supportive of anything that NRA has done. So that's nothing new. What you're seeing is some groups are deciding that it's politically correct to bash NRA. And we're really sorry about that. As Wayne said when he tried to explain to police officers that that letter did not tar and feather all of them. It was aimed at specific cases of law enforcement abuse at the federal level, that he never meant all cops. And our members understood that he never meant all cops. And I think we can mend that rift rather quickly.
My guest is Tanya Mataksa, the executive director of the NRA's lobbying group, the Institute for Legislative Action. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with the NRA's chief lobbyist, Tanya Mataksa. I think the number one issue in your legislative agenda would be to repeal the ban on assault weapons, yes?
That's our number one federal issue, yes.
Explain to me why you would like to see assault weapons legalized again.
Well, first of all, assault weapons is a term of art. What was banned in 1994 were 19 specific firearms who didn't shoot any faster, didn't make any bigger holes, were exactly the equivalent, almost exactly, except cosmetically, the equivalent of the 600-plus rifles that were on the so-called good list. Even ATF does not understand the difference. They held up the importation of Henry rifles. This is a rifle that was used in the last century because they didn't understand the law. The law is vague. It doesn't have anything to do with the criminal use of firearms because less than 1% of these guns are used in crime. So we believe it's important that you know what you're talking about when you write laws, number one. And number two, that laws are written that do something, that have an efficacy for their purpose.
What do your members use assault weapons for?
Hunting, self-defense, target shooting. There are matches that use these. By the way, this so-called, as you like to call it, assault weapon, it's not a real assault weapon. The military uses assault weapons, true assault weapons. These are fully automatic firearms that once you pull the trigger, many shots will come out of the barrel. What we're talking about in this law are firearms that you only shoot one bullet with each pull of the trigger. Now, there's a big difference. The problem is that some of these firearms that are banned, which only shoot one bullet with each pull of the trigger, are made to look like, by certain cosmetic additions, to look like their military counterparts. And this is why people want to ban them, because they look like them. They are not, but they look like them.
President Clinton has said he would veto the bill if a bill repealing the ban is passed. Are you going to try to make sure Clinton does not get reelected?
We're going to watch President Clinton veto his presidency away. Yeah, I believe it's rather clear that NRA is not going to support the current incumbent that lives at 1600 White and Pennsylvania Avenue.
Now tell me why guns are such an important issue for you personally.
Because it's not about guns, it's about freedom. I am the daughter of a man who emigrated to this country. He came from Russia, the Soviet Union at that time. He was an artist who had been terrorized when the Soviets took over the Russia of old. He knew what it was like to live under that kind of regime, and told me a lot about freedom and how this was the best country on earth. And so I guess my father's teachings have rubbed off on me. I believe that the struggle for the hearts and minds of this country is a very important one, and I believe that the Second Amendment is a very integral part of the Bill of Rights and is an individual right, and that's why I'm here. I think that without the Second Amendment, the First is on very shaky ground, as are the other eight.
The Second Amendment says a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Interpret that for us. What's your interpretation of the Second Amendment?
My interpretation is that the right of the people is the most significant part of that amendment. It means the right of each and every person. The well-regulated militia refers to the unorganized militia that is necessary for the safety of a free state. And the free state is each individual state. And what our founding fathers meant was that they wanted to have an unorganized militia that could be called up by the state, and therefore every person was a member of that militia. But it was not the National Guard or a standing army. They had great fear of standing armies.
I want to get back to how you became so involved in the gun issue and in the NRA. How did you learn to shoot?
My husband taught me how to shoot. I didn't know very much about guns till I met him.
What do you use your guns for?
I am a competitive pistol shooter. I enjoy doing trap and skeet. I've done. I go hunting. I've done some rifle shooting. I sort of like them all. It's good recreation. It's fun, and I also have one in my home for self-defense. And now that we've fixed the carry laws in Virginia, I intend to apply for a carry permit as soon as I can on July 1st.
What would you like to carry?
I would carry a handgun.
Where would you keep it?
Depending on where I am. I'll be able to keep it in my car. I'll be able to keep it on my person. Now, that's not to say I'm going to go out armed every day. It's just that I will now have the choice as to when I want to take it with me and when I don't want to take it with me. And that's what the NRA is all about. It's about choice.
Tanya Mataksa is the executive director of the NRA's lobbying group, the Institute for Legislative Action. This is Fresh Air.